Good morning. Hello, everyone. My name is John Palfrey from the Berkman Center at Harvard Law School, and on behalf of Urs Gasser and myself, would like to welcome you and thank you very much for joining us here in DC today. We have spent the last year and a half or so on this research project with the help of several of the people in the room, and hugely grateful for the collaboration that has resulted in this these reports that we're releasing today. Also very much welcome future collaboration from each of you in the room and discussion today about what we're going to talk about. Just in full disclosure, there's someone in the back of the room, nice man who's got a camera going, and so this event is being webcast and recorded, so just to ensure that you know that any comments you make, whether or not you attribute them to yourself, will be recorded for posterity, but also are being webcast right now. So in terms of the format for today, what we were thinking was to have a short discussion now of what we found in this paper with respect to interoperability, and hopefully have a period of discussion amongst those here in the room. Go roughly speaking till about 12. There'll be some food out there, and hope that you'll be able to stick around and have lunch with us. But the formal program will, roughly speaking, just go for about 40 minutes, and then hopefully we'll have a nice meal and understand that you may need to get back to your day from there. So I will introduce in a second my colleague, Professor Dr. Urs Gasser from the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland, but wanted to give first an overview of how we got to where we are today and what the framework of the report that we're releasing is. Then Urs will talk about the primary findings of the report, and then hopefully we can talk about whether you think we're right or wrong, what other further work we ought to do in this area. So the idea of this particular study on interoperability came from the connection of a few strands of thinking. One is, a few years ago, some colleagues of ours did a project that brought together 16 people from different countries and released a paper called the Open E-Policy Report. It was in partnership with IBM and Oracle and others. And one of the key findings in this report was the topic of interoperability was one that popped in basically everybody's mind in that report, and came up as the top theme. Similarly, as we talked to people who were in the computing industry and end users, increasingly this term interoperability kept coming up. Where we come from at Harvard Law School is a research center called the Berkman Center. It was founded on the idea of working on the theme of openness on the internet. And we found that the term interoperability, the way that it was used, was much like openness. It was something that was sort of like apple pie. It was good. We thought it was something we liked, but very hard to define and needed definition in different circumstances. So the idea for this research project was to take this term, interoperability, in the ICT context and try to dissect it, try to get to why does this in fact matter? Is it interoperability per se that we're after? Are we after something else? How does it come about? What are the primary approaches? And if you were taking the public interested view, how would you go about trying to accomplish it again? What are the primary modes by which you can get there, through regulation, through industry partnership, and so forth, and try to detail it? So the way that we went about this particular research project was by using a series of different methodologies. We would have loved to have had extensive economic sort of empirical data. That doesn't really exist in this particular area. But we decided to go with a case study approach. So Urs will talk about this in a moment. But we decided to dig in on three key areas and then look at a bunch of subsidiary areas in terms of how interoperability has come to pass or might come to pass in those areas, and then to write those up in the form of the short little books that you have in front of you. We held a series of meetings, two primary workshops, one in Switzerland, one in the United States, which had great people like Stacey Baird sitting here who participated, experts who have written on this topic otherwise, and people from industry, academia, and so forth. And then to do a whole bunch of interviews, to interview as many people as who would talk to us on these three case studies. And the three cases that we resolved to dig in on are DRM protected music, the idea of digital identity and interoperability within that, and then a subset of web services called mashups, and then to go from there to try to draw some common themes. And very important to this whole idea was to do it in an international framework. So one of the things that we believe deeply is that these topics on the internet have to be studied in the context of a global economy. It's fitting, I think, to be in the Reagan building and dedicated to international trade and other things in this context. But we were hoping that we could also draw out some of the tensions between the European view, which is represented by Professor Dr. Gasser here, and the American view on how interoperability comes to pass. I think it's no secret that the Europeans tend to prefer a state-driven approach in some contexts to some of these issues, which we can dig into momentarily, and that we here in the United States tend to prefer a private sector-led approach, and we're trying to figure out how to explore that and to talk about it in a meaningful fashion. So if I might, I'll turn it over to Professor Dr. Gasser here to talk about what we found in the in these case studies and in the white paper overall, and then hopefully we'll turn it over for broader discussion.
Thank you very much, John. Hello, everyone, also from my side. As John pointed out, I'm the European voice on this panel.
So you couldn't tell from the accent.
Yeah, that's right. So forgive me if my opinions are occasionally different from yours, but I think we're here also to discuss critically our findings. What I would like to do is to talk a little bit about the white paper and to summarize basically the findings we present in here, assuming that you haven't had the time to read it within the 10 minutes since you arrived. And then we can dig deeper in the areas of the three case studies if you like. So as you can take actually from the table of contents, we've tried to achieve a couple of things to discuss and address a couple of things in this white paper. First of all, we tried to figure out what actually ICT interoperability means. What is it, interoperability? At a glance, that seems rather a straightforward question, but the answer is not easy at all, as it turns out. Second, we tried to answer whether interoperability is a sound policy goal or not, and under what circumstances it may be. And third, the white paper deals, as well as the case study, of course, with the question how to achieve higher levels of ICT interoperability once we decide that this is a goal we want to achieve. All this, as John pointed out, is based on case studies and interviews and materials, a broad range of materials. Of course, we haven't written down everything we explored, so this is kind of a conclusion what we see here from a much broader research effort. So let me turn to the first question. What is interoperability? What does it mean? I think the finding in our white paper is that interoperability is a horse that is difficult to catch. Interoperability means different things to different people in different contexts. We've done quite a bit of literature review, but haven't been able to identify one uniform single definition of what interoperability means. So we decided to work with a working definition, which may not be 100% precise and fit every context and every possible field of application, but is helpful to have a common understanding what we're talking about. In our working definition, we suggest that interoperability can be understood as the ability to transfer useful information across computer systems, applications, but also, for instance, organizations to make them work together. What interoperability means becomes much more clear when we focus on what can we do, actually, when we live in an interoperable environment. And as you know, our primary focus has been the digital environment and the internet in particular. So I would like to give you a few examples. Of course, interoperability enables you to buy songs, for instance, on one music platform and to play it on whatever device you like, whether it is an iPod or another device. Interoperability would allow you to create an avatar in one virtual world and to transfer this avatar to another virtual world and use it there. Or given the average age in here, probably a more appealing example, to book your flights and hotels on
I think you sell everybody short. How many avatars in the room? A couple.
I take it back.
Okay. Could have counted on Stacy for that. Right?
That's right. Or, you know, to book your flights and hotels on one travel agency kind of platform on the internet, but then, you know, also being able to move to other online platforms without retyping all the personal information you have in your profile, all your preferences, and so forth. Or if you would come up with a cool business idea that involves, for instance, to use Google Maps and build something on top of it, a cool application, to have the possibility to do so. So these are a few examples what interoperability can mean in different contexts in practice, and probably we'll have time to come back to that and talk a little bit more about these applications. So I think these examples, and certainly what we've done in terms of research in the three case studies, suggest that probably even more important than to find a uniform definition of what interoperability means is to make clear in every context what we're talking about. So I mentioned interoperability is context specific, and when we have a conversation about it, and that's certainly one finding, it makes sense to be precise about what is your understanding when you use the term or concept interoperability right now, and what is my understanding, because a lot of the disagreement, I think, has to do with that we all think about different things when we use the term. Examples also illustrate the second point that is probably more important than the mere definitional issue, and that is interoperability is by no means only a technical issue. It's very important if you want to make systems work together that you take into account not only the technology but also the workflows, the processes, and ultimately the people using and designing the technology. There are legal components too that need to play together to have an interoperable ICT environment. That's one of the lessons we learned also from our partners and contributors in this project. This was a recurring theme, that interoperability is not just a technical issue, it's much broader, it's multi-layered and much more complicated, and that makes it of course interesting for us as researchers. Now let me turn to the second question. Is interoperability, generally speaking, a sound policy goal? The short answer, based on our research, is yes, it is. It is because, at least most of the time, it fosters innovation, enhances competition, and is good for consumers because it gives them more choice. The positive relation between interoperability and consumer choice is rather straightforward. If computer systems, applications, and devices from different vendors work in concert, work together, consumers can freely choose among them and test and mix and match it according to their needs. You could play, for instance, in an interoperable DRM space, music that you buy on one platform on whatever device you like, or, you know, move, as I illustrated, from one online travel agent platform to the next one. So it gives you more choice among devices, services, and so forth. Now, slightly more complicated is to establish a link between increased levels of interoperability and innovation and competition. John pointed it out already. We did quite some research and interviews and so forth to find out whether there is empirical evidence that would make this case, right? That would be the easiest thing for us as lawyers, if you would have empirical evidence suggesting there is a causal relationship. The more interoperable the environment is, the more innovation you will see in this given environment. Unfortunately, at least in the areas we studied, There is a lack of empirical data on this question.
If anybody out there would like to fund a large empirical research study, I'm sure somebody would be happy to do it. It doesn't exist so far.
So this is a gap. Now, what we then try to do is to identify what the Americans call anecdotal evidence, which is a completely nonsense from a European perspective, because anecdotal evidence doesn't exist, actually. We found other evidence, anecdotal evidence, that more interoperability, in fact, leads to more innovation. And you will find plenty of examples in the three reports, in the three case studies, and we also documented this, or listed kind of cases of anecdotal evidence on our online resources that are available as of today. Now, again, I think it's helpful to make an example here. A good example, what types of innovation occur if we are moving towards a more interoperable environment is Facebook. As we discussed in one of our studies, in the Mashup case study, written by John and his team, we show there that Facebook's decision to open up itself and to invite programmers from outside and users to create cool applications that can be used on Facebook, I mentioned just one, music discovery tool called iLike, for instance, has attracted a lot of people writing cool applications. Over 5,000 such applications have been seen by now. Some of them got users from day one to day two, like in the range of 0 to 850,000 overnight. It's pretty amazing. And these are applications not provided by Facebook, but written by other outside developers and users. But that is only possible because Facebook opened up its APA, its interface.
Thank you.
So this is, I think, a nice little case study that shows how interoperable services may drive user innovation, may lead to user innovation, users that improve a product, an existing product, such as Facebook. So it's not Facebook itself or the firm improving the product, being innovative, but it's also its users. So while we concluded in our white paper that more interoperability leads generally to more competition and innovation, we don't say, and that's an important point, that this is always the case. We don't say that. The economists have pointed out, and you will find the references also in the report, that lower levels of interoperability may create stronger incentives, actually, for companies to work on certain types of innovation. And these types of innovation are often referred to as radical innovations. What I described a minute ago in the Facebook context would count as incremental, small-step innovations. But there is a different type of innovation, the more radical innovation, and it's unclear whether this type of innovation is also fostered by increased levels of interoperability. The reason is straightforward. If you as a company have an idea for a revolutionary product, for a big innovation, for a radical innovation, and you have to consider whether you want to work on that and bring it on the market, you of course consider the question, how strong is the market already? How strong are the competitors, and also what are the users doing? Is the market structured in a way, and we're talking about markets with strong network effects here, that the market locks in consumers, makes it very expensive for consumers to switch from the current services and devices to new ones, things that are radically new? Then, you know, the incentive structure may change. Given the fact that higher degrees of interoperability unleash network effects. So to give example, if many people would, or if music consumers are using or buying songs and can and use them on every single device they want of their choice, it gets harder to introduce a completely new, radical new music distribution system. So that would be an instance. And the other perspective would be if you take Apple's success, the iTunes and iPod story, it may have benefited from the fact that we have a relative or had a relatively low level of interoperability on the online music market, giving strong incentives to the company to come up with a radical innovation and to, of course, gain a lot of money, because there is the chance to establish a temporary monopoly, so to speak, for such a company. So from an economic perspective, there is this complicating factor, so to speak, that not every type of innovation probably is fostered by higher degrees of interoperability. But overall, we concluded higher degrees of interoperability is good for at least certain types of innovation, and in particular, incremental innovations. It gets even more complicated.
The Europeans love the complication parts, right?
Yeah, you can then make it easier.
Yeah, we'll make it simple and dumb it down.
So, as we addressed in the white paper as well as in the case studies, interoperability, high levels of interoperability can have drawbacks. Privacy and security concerns are the one that are most frequently mentioned in various conversations. And the basic argument is straightforward. Increased interoperability means increased access and increased transfer of data and information across systems, as we defined it. Now, this in turn also increases the risk that people with bad intentions can interfere and place a piece of bad code into the system. The more open you are, the greater the risk, so the argument goes, that someone is doing harm to the systems. One example could be, in this context, email. Email is a very interoperable system, apparently. And at the same time, you also see that we have to deal with viruses and spam and all kind of things we don't like, which in part is a consequence of its openness. It makes it easier to do bad things with it. Privacy, the same. The argument goes, higher interoperability among, for instance, identity management systems, digital ID systems, as one of our case study, increases the risk that someone can extract personal information when the transactions between the platforms takes place. However, our viewpoint is slightly different. We would argue that these drawbacks are often the result of a particular implementation or design, so that much of it is not a feature of higher levels of interoperability itself, but rather how interoperability has been designed, achieved on the one hand side, on the other hand side, it's just basically how people with bad intentions use the interoperable infrastructure. So it seems problematic that we take something that people do in a wrong way with bad intentions as an argument against interoperability itself. It seems to be problematic from our viewpoint.
And certainly can't make the case, I think, that open systems tend to be less secure. This is one of the things that's recurred in the debates on ICTs. And I think it's likewise, you can't just say that because it's interoperable, it's less secure. It may be that it opens itself to new vulnerabilities, but overall, we certainly didn't find that open meant less secure, or interoperable meant less secure, right?
Yeah, exactly. So in conclusion, we argue in all the papers that interoperability is generally a sound policy goal, that the benefits associated with it outweigh the potential drawbacks. That leads us to the third question we addressed in our research, and this that is how to get there, how to achieve higher levels of ICT interoperability. I think the key finding here is there is no single way and no silver bullet solution to it. To the contrary, so our finding, interoperability can be achieved by multiple means. This is, I think, an important point. In our case studies, we've explored the different means and discussed various approaches, and we summarized it on page 20 of the white paper. So you get have an overview there. It's this graph here. And we grouped the different approaches along two dimensions. On the one hand side, we distinguished between regulatory approaches, which are state-driven approaches, and on the other hand, non-regulatory approaches, more like the private actors oriented approaches. And we grouped them along the other dimension with unilateral approaches, the one end of the spectrum, and collaborative approaches on the other end of the spectrum. So I don't want to address each approach here and to go into details. You will find that, of course, in the materials you got today. However, what I would like to do is to focus on three or four of them, the three or four of them that are discussed most controversially. On the private actor side, unilateral design and IP licensing is a cluster that it may often be underappreciated as a means to achieve higher degrees of interoperability. In all our case studies, though, we have seen that IP licensing has played a very significant role in getting to higher levels of interoperability. The Facebook example would be one. Microsoft's Place for Sure initiative in the context of DRM music would be another one.
And the basic idea with these would be a single firm decides to open itself up and to offer other people the opportunity to interoperate with it, right? It's sort of a unilateral, one firm does it, and it's usually by some kind of a license or agreement. And I think this is something that we found in every single case study that we looked at. There was some extent to which this came to pass, and it often caused interoperability-driven innovation to happen very, very quickly by virtue of just one firm making the decision and then doing it for whatever market reason they may have done it.
And I emphasize that here because usually, or kind of, as you know, it's a heated debate, it's a hot topic, this interoperability problem or challenge. And often it is argued that IP law is only used to prevent interoperability to happen. And I think that's, or we conclude, that is not accurate based on what we've seen. In fact, IP law can be used both ways. It plays both ways. It's bidirectional. Of course, you can use your IP laws to prevent interoperability. That's what Apple is doing with iPod and iTunes. But on the other hand, we found plenty of examples where actually IP law through licensing was used to collaborate, to work together bilaterally with other firms to enable enable devices and services to interoperate. The second approach that is hotly debated is open standards on the side of non-regulatory approaches. If you look at this chart here, some proponents actually argue that open standards is the only way that leads to an interoperable environment. And open standards, just to give a quick definition, already the definition is controversial, as many of you know. What is an open standard? Well, it's characterized by an initiative where many people can work together, companies can work together. It's a formalized process that is open for participation for companies that are in one sector in the ICT market. And the second element, once there is consensus about the standard, that the specifications of this standard are freely available to whomever is interested in this standard and using this standard. So this is the basic idea behind it. Now, as I said, some observers argue that this is the best way and even the only way to get to an interoperable environment. Our position is slightly different. We are very, I emphasize that, very sympathetic with open and collaborative efforts and initiatives to achieve interoperability, that's no question. And we also highlighted many of the advantages of open approaches in our research. So please don't get me wrong, we're not arguing open standards are a bad thing. We argue it's a very good thing. But we are honest from what we've learned that it's not always the case that it's the best approach or the most effective and efficient and even flexible tool to get there to achieve interoperability. We learned, for instance, and we've seen that open standards initiatives are, of course, voluntary efforts and that the effectiveness of the approach to work with open standards may be lowered if very important players in the market don't join this open standard process that would be up for discussion, or even worse, would use IP portfolios to block the process, to interfere with the process. And that's something we've seen, especially in the patent area, in the DRM case study, as well as in the mashup case study, that this is a problem of open standard setting processes. Second, open standard setting processes are in many instances complex. They're time consuming and also expensive. Some observers and some research indicates that it takes on average 5 to 7 years to get to an understanding, an agreement what the standard shall be in such an open standard process, which may be a problem. Timing may be a problem. We don't say again that it's necessarily a problem everywhere, but these are just features of this approach that we have to take into consideration when looking for the best match between the problem we want to solve and the available approaches. There are other arguments in the literature and also pointed out in our research that take a critical view at open standards. Again, we are very sympathetic towards open standards, but try to be honest about what we've learned also in the conversations.
Could I add one thing on open standards, just to go back to the Facebook example, for instance. One of the things we've seen is that often the open standards processes are not the fastest way to get to interoperability, right? You can, as a firm, offer up an environment where people can interoperate and innovate. You could imagine, though, that partly this is built on some open standards. So in the mashup case study, of course, some of the XML-related formats have been developed through open processes. So sometimes the processes are hybrid. You'll see a single firm offering interoperability in one way, which is based upon a lot of hard work that's been gone on in an open standards process. So I think this theme of hybrid approaches is very important. The other advantage I would note about open standards worth highlighting here is stability and sustainability. So one of the things that I worry about after having looked at the mashup case study is a bait and switch problem. So you could imagine a scenario in which a firm opens social from Google or it doesn't matter who's offering it, but allows people based on a contract to build something on top of what they have, but then reserves the right, as almost all terms of service do, to change it at any point, right? And so if the point is thousands and thousands of developers sink lots of money into developing Facebook applications, and then the Facebook guys get taken over or go public or whatever it might be, and they're no longer nice guys on whom you rely, and they start either charging you a ton of money for using their interface or take it away and so forth, there will have been a lot of investment in something that then unilaterally may have been pulled. And you can imagine open standards processes as being one way to avoid this problem of instability or unsustainability in a long-term sense. So I would note that as one of the things in the plus column for open standards, both working with other approaches and then achieving sustainability over time.
Thank you. So moving now from the private actor and private sector approaches towards the regulatory approaches. we've basically approached or explored two possible strategies states may have if they decide to regulate interoperability. One is what we may call specific interventions, and the other one are general approaches to interoperability. With regard to specific approaches, such as, for instance, the disclosure of interoperability information, as the French did, like last year or 2 years ago, in when they amended the French Copyright Act, so that you're obliged to disclose interoperability information if a competitor wants to build an interoperable device under certain conditions, of course, is something that we would call a specific approach. We conclude that specific approaches tend to be problematic. Often they are the result of highly politicized ad hoc interventions and less about the result of careful analysis of the actual problem one wants to solve. And I think the French example, the interoperability provision in the French Copyright Act, is a good illustration of this problem, or something we worry about, that specific approaches tend to be ad hoc and not the result of a careful evaluation. We look closer into the idea of mandating standards, something that of course is also discussed in interoperability debates. Of course, this would be very effective if the government mandates an interoperable standard for all the market participants, but this raises a series of concerns outlined in our work, ranging from high administration and monitoring and even enforcement costs, and then probably even more important, it tends to freeze technology. If government mandates the standards, of course the question raises, is it the right standard, and what if not, and how does it respond to technological development? We all know once the government steps in, it gets hard to change things, so there is a clear problem with that when we talk about mandating standards. Certainly an approach that wouldn't support too much, except in specific context.
I would note one specific context. We have a colleague from the Department of Education here who's done some work in the Eden Project and seeking to do interoperability within schools or within the government framework. We actually think there are a number of examples where that's a very positive approach, where government as a market actor on its own is choosing to make interoperable systems. The thing that we're concerned about are broad-based upfront ex-ante mandated standards for how industry operates, and of the examples we looked at, there weren't any particularly good examples of having done that. So I think we have to distinguish between government as regulating the space and government as regulating itself.
Right, one goes closer to public procurement decisions as well. Maybe one area where mandating standards make sense is emergency communication, right? That's not something we covered in our case studies, but you certainly want to have emergency communications devices, services, and so forth, components work together. So there are instances, but we wouldn't argue that this is like the preferred approach to solve all the problems. Now, lastly, we've emphasized in the white paper that this more intrusive approach, is that this is not the only way governments can act. Before I skip the part, I just wanted to add something on the general laws, right? We differentiated between the specific interventions and the general approaches. So a word on the general approaches. A general approach would be competition law. General approaches are usually laws, regulations that take place or that regulate after the facts, after something has gone wrong. For instance, if a dominant player, and Microsoft has gone through that in Europe, if a dominant player refuses to disclose interoperability information and thereby abuses its market position, this may be an instance where general laws, here competition law, antitrust law, may play a key role to address this situation and help to move towards higher degrees of ICT interoperability. Consumer protection laws might also be such a general approach, general laws that can be used to address certain problems associated with low levels of interoperability. There was a case in Europe where the producer of compact discs was required to label them and to make clear to the consumer that this compact disc can't be listened to on portable devices, for instance. So to create transparency is such an approach that we think is much more suitable than this specific ex-ante intervention. So we're much more in favor of general laws, using general laws to solve the problems where we can.
Just to highlight that last one, though, I think that our findings were that the general laws of consumer protection and competition so far work very well as a backstop, so that our thinking was in the instances where government, FTC, for instance, and others stand by and see that there are existing laws being broken through dominant market positions, that that's the moment for intervention rather than doing it up front before the issues arising, because we've seen a lot of innovation happening in the marketplace itself.
Excellent. And then, as I wanted to say earlier on, government and states can not only intervene and, you know, regulate in this restrictive sense, they can also make contributions in a more positive way by enabling, for instance, or facilitating standard setting processes. So states are also facilitators of standard setting processes. They may encourage public-private partnerships or funding research, for instance, into interoperability issues. So it's not only to say everything governments are considering or all the approaches are highly problematic per se. There are certainly enabling approaches that are not problematic at all in our view. So in conclusion, and probably afterwards you can add the stuff I missed here. Of course, I missed a lot. On page 27 of the white paper, you will find a process-oriented approach towards interoperability, a process solution that we suggest. It's structured divided into six steps. I think the most important ones are the first one, number three, and number six. The first one saying, before we start to talk about interoperability policy and regulation, it's very important to identify what problem we want to solve. We've learned that interoperability is not a goal in itself, but is used as a means to achieve something, say competition, innovation, consumer choice, whatever it may be. So we have to answer first, what are the actual goals, or what is the goal that we want to achieve? Second, and that's the third point here, consider the full spectrum of approaches. We touched upon three or four here, and much more to read in our case studies what the approaches to interoperability are. Use the toolbox, consider the full range of means and approaches available, and it's, as I said, as we pointed out, it's not a silver bullet solution there. It's not only one means that leads to interoperability, but be context-specific, analyze the situation, analyze, for instance, how mature is the market we're talking about, what are the stakeholders involved, how does their incentive structure look like, how fast is the technological development in this area, how fast is the technology moving, and then look from that, move to the question, what are the features and characteristics of the different approaches in our tool set, and where do we have the best match to solve the problem or to achieve the goal we identified in the first place. And third, and that's the sixth conclusion here on page 27, in the majority of the cases, the private sector, in our view, is best suited to address interoperability problems, to address this challenge. However, the state plays an important role in the enabling sense on the one hand side, and on the other hand side, and that is really important in our view, to step in if things go wrong, if there is market failure, and then the state should be prepared to intervene. And we've seen, especially in the Microsoft case, also the problems with this approach. It takes a long, long time for governments and for the legal system to deal with this highly complicated issue with this interoperability challenge. That's it from my side for the moment.
Great. Well, I think since we've had the mic for quite so long that we should probably wrap up our comments there, but we'd very much welcome critiques, comments, others from the experts here here in the audience. Would you mind, sir, yeah, if you would come to the microphone if you're willing, since it's being webcast, or take the microphone, that would be great. And I'd love to hear about your experience in achieving interoperability in an important context as well.
That would take longer than we have.
I see,
But just real briefly, the approach that we took working with vendors and school districts.
Which is from the Department of Education, for those who are,
sorry. To develop what we call the schools interoperability frame and set of standards.
That allow data to move across platforms. For instance, you've got a bus route scheduler and a library card issuer and an enrollment attendance module, none of which talk to each other. So when the kid shows up at school to register, somebody has to re-enroll them in each of those. They don't talk. The names are different. The address is wrong.
As parents, we filled out a lot of those forms.
Exactly, right. So anyway, we're trying to do a mashup. And the but in the process of doing that, I think your model is interesting because it was definitely a collaborative process where we worked with vendors to try to get it together, but we established a number of government incentives for them to do that, including our participation in it.
And as a customer, in essence.
Yes.
Yeah.
But also as a by making it a requirement of some of our grants for information systems that these interoperability standards be used, and also by encouraging states and their competitions to use those standards as their design criteria as they were working through. So in a way, it was moving around a lot of that dimension that you were talking about and using a number of different parts of it to make it work.
Oh, that's excellent as an example. Well, while you're up there, would you offer any critique? Did we get anything wrong that from your experience, you know, we've either underemphasized, overemphasized, or just simply messed it up?
No, I don't think so at all. It's just that anytime you have a two-dimensional chart, the world's a lot more complicated.
That's right. So we just say hybrid approaches, collaborative, right, community-based, all those things are good.
Right.
Well, thank you for your great work from the Department of Education on that project, and certainly one of the many examples, I think, where a collaborative public-private partnership has gotten a lot done for consumers and, in this case, for kids and families. Thank you.
I just can add one thing. It's an excellent point that illustrates that blended approaches are usually or often the most promising approaches to solve the interoperability problem in a given context. So I'm grateful for this point and clarification. We also mentioned it in our documents, but I didn't mention it here, so that's a wonderful point.
And one thing about the blended approach is I think it changes over time. So if consider again the Facebook example, the Web 2.0 examples, one of the things that's great about the innovation that's happened there is it's been relatively ad hoc in many cases. There are some open standards on which it's based, but single firms have said, okay, why don't you build some applications based upon our open environment. You can imagine, though, at different points in the marketplace, you might want a quite different approach. So in this bait and switch example that I raised, it might be that several years down the line where it's a much more mature marketplace where other approaches may make sense to come in. So I think this time dimension is one thing that we'd emphasize is important. Stacy, would you mind coming up again to the mic? Thank you. For your huge webcast audience out there,
yeah,
Mr. Baird.
You. Right, exactly, and thank you. Let me just first ask a couple of clarifying questions. To the last point, actually, the blended approach, you would say, is appropriate in terms of government involvement, where government should be involved at all,
mm-hmm.
as opposed
right.
to government should be involved because the blended approach works.
I think that it would be, again, just to emphasize the case-by-case nature of this, which is it matters a lot what your goal is, right? My goal may happen to be consumer protection. I'm quite interested in consumer choice. We're interested in achieving innovation and so forth. You might say in that context, it's quite important to have the FTC involved as a backstop, ensuring you know, that things that companies are saying, in fact, are getting done. But you might have another instance in which there's absolutely no requirement or need for the government to be involved at all. And I think one of the things that we've seen in every single one of the case studies, these three case studies, DRM Protected Music, Mashup, and Digital ID, are three of them that we did. We also looked across dozens of other examples. In almost every one, the private sector is getting a ton done in terms of achieving interoperability. So the concept of the hybrid or the blended approach is really just to say there are a lot of tools in the toolbox that can be used, and depending on the time and the end goals, you may or may not want the government involved in the picture. I think the education example is a terrific one where you can't imagine having an interoperable environment without having central government involvement. But there are many instances where, you know, I don't think the government has any place right now in the Web 2.0 environment where you're seeing enormous innovation at the moment.
Right, and actually that gets to my second point. in regard to the sixth conclusion, that industry is generally best positioned to solve the interoperability problems, could you get more a little more granular on a point you made, Urs, that emergency services, and in this case the Department of Education, and this may not fit because I don't know the Department of Education situation, but certainly in context of emergency services, that mandates of interoperability are what you're saying would be a reasonable solution. You know, for instance, the emergency services where there's an absolute need for government involvement, it's a high priority for government, excuse me, to meet the needs of national security and, you know, police safety and those issues. But distinguish the requirement for interoperability and, along with that, the facilitating of industry developing interoperable solutions as opposed to mandating a specific technical solution. Mm-hmm. But your point was that they should, that mandating interoperability may be a logical step, but mandating, you if I read it correctly, you typically are saying mandating specific technical solutions are inflexible and have all the encumbrances of governance that doesn't necessarily work in this environment.
Right. So I didn't mean to say that this should be done, that we should mandate standards in emergency communication. My colleague Victor Meyer Schoenberger has done extensive research on that. He's at the Kennedy School at Harvard. And I haven't studied it in that detail, and I'm aware, of course, that the ways to get to interoperable system, even within emergency communication in this area, that there are various approaches to do so, and each approach, again, at a very granular level, has advantages and drawbacks, and I don't want to suggest this is the right way to go. I use this as an example where the role of governments getting deeper into the technological choices and working more closely and using the power ultimately working more closely with industry may be a good example where, you know, for this exception, basically.
Right,
at least speaking personally, I think, though, Stacey, if your point is there's a distinction between convening and requiring interoperability in a high priority government setting versus mandating a specific outcome of a process, I think it's very hard, you're hard-pressed to say that there are lots of examples where the government has done a good job of saying, this is the particular standard, use this XML scheme or so forth, right? Rather than saying, it is a requirement to make an interoperable system, we're going to be supportive of this. And I think this, again, comes back to, what are you doing this for, right? Are you doing it because you want a specific outcome, which is to say, you want, when people, you know, call 911, they'll get to the right place, or is it that you're trying to drive innovation or something else. I think what we focused on here was to say, if in fact what you're seeking is ICT interoperability to drive innovation, generally speaking, the private sector has been doing a better job of that.
Right, and I'll just add one last question and then I'll relinquish the microphone. All of what I've read and what you describe, including the fact that there's not much empirical data to evidence any aspect of interoperability in the context of the internet and the digital environment, you conclude that it really needs to be a case-by-case examination to consider whether there should be interoperability and how to go about achieving interoperability. Does all of this, everything, putting the whole package together of everything you've studied, to me it implies that everything about what we're talking about is nascent. The industries are nascent in terms of each of the various case studies, including those case studies, or those studies that you've done that weren't fully fleshed out in the report. So is that a fair conclusion that really all of this stuff is nascent and it's kind of, you have to look at everything that you discuss in that context?
After you.
It's a dangerous question. I would say yes, in a way yes, but of course it depends what is your criterion of comparison. It's relatively young, the markets we're considering here, it's true. Some of the case studies, or like some of the markets we studied, are more mature. Take TRM, for example. And there you also see why it's a dangerous conclusion, because of course the consumer protection side, in this heated debate, would argue, well, we've waited long enough, right? Because you could hijack this argument and say, well, we are talking in general about very premature markets. And so let's, you know, given the conclusion that private actors are usually best suited to solve the problem, just give them more time. So this is, of course, the way you could hijack the recommendations we make. I'm not convinced that this is the case now in DRM, for instance. So therefore, I really believe we have also to be very specific. Even overall, these are, you know, premature markets, and it's evolving, it's fast developing. Still, there are differences within the ICT market, and the only thing we can recommend is certainly, or the one thing we recommend is to be as specific as possible when defining the market, when looking at the sector, the industry sector we're talking about. And like in competition law cases where you have to define the relevant market and analyze it very carefully and in a very granular way, and depending on this analysis you made, to get to different results within the broader cake ICT market. That's correct.
So just to answer that slightly differently, I think these are all quite nascent, but it's relative. So one of the things that we did was we tried to look at three things, the mashup space being very, very new, digital identity being one where people have been working on it for a while, but there are a lot of important efforts, IBM, Microsoft, many of the big players having, you know, huge investments and very effective strategies so far, but no kind of market clearing approach. And then DRM, where clearly billions of dollars are being traded in the relevant market, but it's still moving. I think where we come down is in each of these cases, because it is relatively new, there's a fairly high burden to show that there's market failure before an intervention makes sense. And we certainly heard a distinction between those involved in our workshops who were from Europe saying that, you know, it's sort of sooner rather than later to intervene, and people in the United States tending to say, you know, let the market play out. I think that distinction, which one would have guessed, certainly played out in our conversations. We've got, please, come, if you wouldn't mind coming to the mic just so it would be webcast, please. Thank you.
All right, well, I'm Braden Cox. I'm at the Policy Council at the Association for Competitive Technology. And see, I got a question, a comment, and a critique, so I'll just
Great,
throw these
out.
First, let me say that I commend the report. I think there's a lot of closed thinking behind openness, and I think that you've added a lot to the dialogue about openness and interoperability and them not necessarily being the same thing. Mm-hmm. But first, I guess the comment I have is that what we haven't discussed today is that there are a lot of business models that are driven in pushing this interoperability, or at least openness, as a way for interoperability. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, there are a lot of other ways to achieve interoperability through intellectual property rights, through licensing, and other ways. And I think our public policy debate has been somewhat hijacked by this discussion and this push for openness without the due consideration of the other areas for achieving interoperability. Mm-hmm. Let's see, my critique, though, is the discussion on competition policy and antitrust. You mentioned this as kind of a targeted approach, and even on your page 20, you don't even call it any competition policy, antitrust. You call it a framework for cooperation. I take a little bit of, I think that actually it can be, in the merger context, it can be not necessarily a framework for cooperation. And in general, competition law is like any other kind of regulation. Even though it's ad hoc, it can be competitor-driven and even politically motivated. I think that you should actually call that something different other than framework for cooperation. But finally, let me get to the question here. It seems like when we think about interoperability, we really have to know what it is that we're talking about interoperability of. Maybe we don't necessarily want applications to be interoperable, but platforms, and there are lots of different platforms out there. Facebook, you mentioned one, could be the Windows operating system or any other kind of operating system. Maybe we want those interoperable, but maybe they interoperate on their own given consumer and market demand. Windows is actually very interoperable with lots of different companies and plugins and other devices that can work with that, even though it's a proprietary system. And so I guess to what extent do you think if we're talking about spectrum, does that matter? What's the public policy role there versus applications and software? You mentioned even with mandating open standards, some people point to GSM as a great example of the proliferation of cellular handsets and technology in Europe. That was a mandated standard. In the U.S., we've had competing standards. But the U.S. right now is actually the leader when it comes to 3G technology. And all the technology that's even GSM-based, it's going to be 3G in Europe, is based on CDMA, which is U.S.-based technology. So it seems like there can be competition among standards, but it really depends on what it is that we're talking about, interoperability of software or spectrum or any other kind of IT.
Sure. So at one level, this is a critical point, which is interoperability can be accomplished at lots of different layers in the stack. So if you look, in fact, in the third of the case studies where we're talking about the mashups, you show kind of where does that play? Is that in the logic layers, in the content layer? Is it deeper down? And I think it is very important to note that sometimes you want interoperability at different levels. And so that's just a conversation to be had where you want that to be accomplished. I think, obviously, it's very important, as our colleague Jonathan Zittrin argues, to have platforms that are generative, that places that open themselves up to allow other innovation to occur on top of them is a good idea, generally. And it's one of the things that on which this industry has been built. So, TCP/IP and many of the sort of lower layer things, obviously allowed for lots of innovation to happen. And where things get closed off, further up in the stack, there may be less of a danger, right? So I think you do have to be very precise and say, where do you want the interoperability to occur?